accession number 27083, Reel 20.
She turned to wave again, and then she stepped into the car, and even on board you could hear the appalling squelch as she sank into the rather luxurious upholstery of the car. So that was that one. We returned to Malta, and shortly after we got there, my predecessor left to go back home. And we had dinner together at the Union Club, and it was usual sort of time in the evening, sort of 8 to 9 o'clock, and he was going to go back overland, so he was going to catch the night ferry to Naples or wherever, and then pick up a car and then drive back, and, you know, this was his choice. That was that. And in due course he cut it rather fine, we thought. And he left to go down to the dockyard and catch the ferry. And I forget who else was with us, but there were a couple of others. And we stayed on a bit and we had another cup of coffee or whatever. And then, entirely unhurried, my predecessor returned. He'd forgotten his passport. He'd forgotten his briefcase, I think that was it, which he tucked away behind his chair, and it contained his passport. But he was the sort of chap, it didn't really matter what he did, but he always got away with it, even though the odds against it were stupendous. Of course, he caught his ferry. I've already described the normal sweeping routine, so I won't go on about that. And
people
once
were sweeping Second World War mines still. That was the purpose.
Yes, absolutely.
And you were sweeping ours or Germans?
I think in the main German. There may have been some Italian, but no, not ours. Not ours at all. After my predecessor had gone, I assumed the duties of senior staff officer, and as such, it was my responsibility to draft up the program and everything to do with operations. I was also flotilla sports officer. There was very little gunnery to be done. There was no fire control, so you really acted as almost as a gunnery instructor rather than a gunnery officer, and supervised a bit of gun drill and so forth.
What were the ships armed with in that way?
It was about the earliest form of single 4-inch. It was only just not a muzzle loader. and so on. But, of course, it wasn't the raison d'etre of the ship at all. I think the next point I ought to mention is that, of course, I went ashore when we got back to Malta to call on my immediate boss, the Admiral, who called himself the Flag Officer of Destroyers, Mediterranean, and he lived in a charming house called Villa Pietà. And I went up there to the usual drill, write my name in the book, and little did I know, but his two daughters were skulking behind a tree in the garden and speculating on who this new chap was, and so on, and rushed to the visitor's book after I left, and then they found out. And two or three weeks later, they got down to that level of the book, and I was asked up to play tennis one Wednesday afternoon. And in those days, Wednesday afternoons were half holidays, and none the worse for that. Well, I stepped onto the court, and there, the other side of the net, was a tall girl in a white tennis dress, and I took one look and thought, God, that's the girl for me. And it was. It happened just like that. And I played rotten tennis, and worse was to come, because during the last set I played, her father, the Admiral, was standing opposite me at the net, and about the only good shot I performed throughout the whole of that afternoon was a good forehand drive, and I sent a screamer straight over the net into the Admiral's stomach. So it wasn't a very, not a very good opening gambit, to say the least. Then, turned over to me by my predecessor, was the daughter of a man who was the chief of staff to the CNC, called Geoffrey Norman. And there was a particular road in the direction of Sliema, not terribly far away, and it was called Sacred Heart Avenue, and that was its formal name. Its colloquial name was Snob's Alley, because every other house was a senior captain or a flag officer. And I'd been introduced to the daughter of this family, a nice girl. We're still great friends, and we see each other from time to time. In due course, I was asked to dinner. And that was fine, except that I didn't know my Malta then at all. And I made arrangements to hire a little car, a tiny little standard. And I wasn't sure precisely which house in Snob's Alley was the one that I was meant to go to. So I went in good time, and I got to a point where I recognized that I was at the lower end of Sacred Heart Avenue. And I smoked in those days, and so I hauled into the curb and lit a cigarette because I was in such good time, and thought, well, I'll just waste the next 5 or 10 minutes and then move on. And by then, I shan't be the first to arrive, and the door will be open, and I shall see a naval steward, and it'll be easy. And hardly had I decided to do this when a car drew in front of me, with a couple of this evening dress. And sure enough, at about the time that I thought I ought perhaps to be moving, they chucked their cigarette ends out of the window, and wound up the window, went round the corner, up into the avenue. And I followed. And sure enough, there was a doorway with lights streaming out, and a young naval steward standing just inside, taking hats and coats and things. So I thought, this is a piece of cake. And I parked, and I sauntered across, and I said good evening to the young steward, and I went along a longish corridor, and then, rather to my surprise, was ushered into the drawing room, which led off to the right. Now, bear in mind, I'd only been to the Norman's house once before, but my recollection was that their drawing room had led off to the left. However, it was too late now, and there I was in the doorway, to be greeted by a quite other person in the form of Vice Admiral Sir Cyril Douglas Pennant, at which point it was perfectly clear that I was in the wrong house. Bear in mind, I was a very young lieutenant. Lady Douglas Pennant, he was charming about it, and Lady Douglas Pennant was rather difficult, because apparently one of the guests to whom she had sent an invitation had not replied, and so she made a rather ungainly rush for her écritoire to look up the list and said, "Is your name so-and-so?" Which it wasn't, and I said so. And meantime, he recovered the situation and was very charming about it, and said, "Here, have a dry martini. You must badly need it." And I said, "Well, thank you very much, sir. Yes, I really do." And there was my captain, Keith Campbell Walter, who advanced on me, and just to add insult to him, said, "Oh, good evening, Guns. I didn't know you were coming." And I said, "Well, I'm not, sir. I'm in the wrong house." So it was pretty embarrassing. And then I went next door, and it was literally next door, to the Norman's house, and apparently this sort of thing was always going on. And on a former occasion, it had happened evidently the other way around. And the Normans were having it was after dinner, and they were all scrambling about on the floor playing charades. And the Douglas Pennants next door had asked Archbishop Gonsi to join them for coffee, and he'd gone to the wrong house. And as I say, somebody was pretending to be a cow and somebody else was milking him, and all that sort of thing. And it was all very difficult, and it was always happening, apparently. So that was this was my early days in Malta. Not long afterwards, I got invited to dinner by Admiral Douglas Pennant, which is jolly nice of him, because I didn't belong to him. He was in charge of the carriers out there. And I can't remember who else was there, and it doesn't really matter. And we had a perfectly nice dinner. And then afterwards, it was a slightly mixed team. On the whole, it was a fairly young team of guests. But there was also the captain of the Triumph, who was a man called Ernie Shattuck, quite a senior captain. And he had a fairly unique reputation. He was a member of the Magic Circle, which I think was probably the only naval member of it. Anyway, he was. And he conducted his affairs on board rather like that. And he reckoned that because there was no tide in the central Mediterranean, you should be able to enter Grand Harbour and secure to a buoy by stopwatch. His navigating officer wasn't entirely convinced of this, but anyway, he was slightly eccentric, to say the least. Well, after dinner was over, and we joined the girls outside in the drawing room, and Sir Douglas Pennant turned to Ernie Shattuck and said, "Now, come on, Ernie, I've got a couple of packs of cards here. Show us one of your tricks." And he, quite obviously not meaning it, said, "Oh, I think I didn't like to keep my boat waiting. I think I'd better get back." "No, come on." Anyway, he was handed two unbroken packs of cards, still in the wrappings and so forth. And he took these, and he said, "Well, if you insist, The little thing I'm going to do requires help. I do need an assistant. By this time, we'd sort of formed almost a line, irrespective of boys and girls and so on. And he walked down the line, looking at everybody. And there were only, I suppose there might have been 10 of us, sort of thing. And then he went back to the beginning again, and he got about a third of it down the line, and he picked on a certain girl and said, come on, my dear. they knelt down on the floor, and he said, now you kneel there on whichever side it was, and I'll kneel alongside you. And he broke the wrappings of the cards, and he shuffled the cards, and he said, now, I'm going to give you the cards, all face down, and it's quite easy. All you have to do is to set the cards out in two lines, black on the left and red on the right, or whichever way around it was. By this time, she was obviously rather embarrassed, quite young, and rather bemused. And he said, I shall know, of course, whether you're getting it right or not, even though the cards are face down. And if I see that you're getting it wrong, I shall tell you so. And so she started off. And she hadn't a clue, any more than anybody else would have had. And she sort of one left and two right and three left and so forth. And from time to time, he interrupted and said, no, that's the wrong side. And so it was moved. And they didn't look at it and check it or anything with Neposib. And they went the whole way through two pairs. It took a little time. And by this time, she was clearly feeling acutely uncomfortable. Now, my dear, let's see how you've done. And they turned them up, and there they all were, all red and all black. Don't ask me to explain that. Immediately after which, Shattuck said, now I really must be off. And he went, and it was getting on. It was close on 11 o'clock, I suppose. And it was time for us all to make our departure. And it fell to me, because I had my little car, it fell to me to give this girl a lift home, which I did. I'd never met her before. She's a nice girl. And she admitted to me in the car that when they'd first started off, we'd lined up after dinner, that she knew that she was going to be picked on. And she said, when I knelt down, I felt acutely uncomfortable, and I hated every minute of it. And that was that. Well, that was really, you might say, nothing to do with me. But just to finish up on Ernie Shattuck, he ended up as flag officer, having been promoted to a rear admiral, flag officer Malayan area, out in the Far East, based on Singapore. And this was a few years later. And I think by this time, he'd separated from his wife. In fact, I'm sure he had. And he had a charming daughter and a man by then that I had as a midshipman in my gunroom in Duke of York went out as his flag lieutenant, fell madly in love with the daughter, and this became obvious to the admiral, and he was sent packing home, which was a sadness. And Shattuck himself, it was his last job as a serving officer in the Navy, and he went back via Tibet and spent some time in some strange monastery in Tibet meditating or what have you. He was a very curious man, very clever, and so on. And obviously I wasn't present for this, but the story goes that he later on he had a flat in London, and he was walking. He was going back to his flat, I think, for lunch one day. And he hadn't got a job, And was rather looking for one, but hadn't found anything yet. And by this time he was fully retired. And he bumped into, in the railway, he bumped into an old friend. They hadn't seen each other for some time, and the friend said, what are you up to? Come and have lunch with me in the senior. And he, Shattuck, expostulated a bit and said, well, he wasn't sure because he was a bit pressed for time. He wasn't the least bit pressed, and he had nothing on the plate at all. And eventually was persuaded to go with his chum to the senior, and they did. And they had a good lunch. That was it. And then afterwards, when they stood outside the club, his friend said, well, I must leave you now because I've got to go down the city. Oh, said, I'm going that way myself. I'll come with you part of the way. And they hadn't gone more than a cricket pitch or so when his friend bumped into some chap from, I think it was Guest, Keel and Nettlefold or some such up north, spoke with a very northern accent, very marked one. Introduced Ernie Shattuck, then turned back to his friend and said things like, in answer to the question, how's things up north? Oh, it is terrible, it is dreadful up there. No this, no that, no sales, and really wrung it out. And after a bit, Ernie Shattuck got a bit short on this and intervened and said, well, you've only yourself to blame. You think about your business the right way. Whereupon the other man, total stranger, took arm and said, hey, lad, are you teaching me my business? And that sort of thing. Yes, said Ernie, I'd be glad to. Hey, lad, well, report to me on, whatever it was, early next week or something. And I'll tell you the truth of the matter. And so forth. And Ernie took him up on this, and he went in and was received with very bad grace, and two empty order books were thrust at him, and he was told to go away, and he had 2 months in which to fill these two books, and if he did, well, his future involvement with the firm might be considered, but it was as vague as that. So he left with the two books. Empty. And back he went to London, and he went into John Barclays and said, I am the European sales manager for Guest, Keel and Nettlefold, which he wasn't. And I'm about to embark on a major European tour, in the course of which I shall have a few spare days. And I'm prepared to do a bit of business on your behalf, if that would be convenient. Mark you, for my tour, I shall require a proper, respectable vehicle. And without going on, he drove out with a Phantom 2 or whatever. And he went away, and 1 month, or maybe in 6 weeks, but well under the two, he returned, and up north he went, and he burst in on this rather strange Norman, and slapped two bulging order books down on his desk, and that was that. And I'm afraid I can't end this story, but it's not the sort of thing that would have been made up, because I can't tell you what happened next and whether he ever got taken on, but that's another matter. And anyway, it's rather beyond my autobiography. So coming back to Fes and Malta, and on a certain Sunday, the first lieutenant, whose wife was out in Malta, and they had a very small child, a boy, and her, I'm not sure that both their parents, respective parents, weren't going to come out for this infant's christening, which was going to take place after church on that Sunday on board usual business, ship's bill and all that stuff. And the chaplain conducting, because we didn't have a chaplain of our own, there was I think he called himself the small ship's chaplain, and he dealt with the destroyers and the minesweepers and so forth. And he was going to conduct the ceremony. And his name was Muspratt. And he was a very good tennis player. He was not such a good chaplain. And noon came, and there was no chaplain. And I bustled round to try and locate this fellow, and failed to do so. And the clock ran on, and by 1 o'clock we'd given him up. And we tried the Mars, and we tried this, we tried everywhere. Nobody knew the whereabouts of the Reverend, not very, Muspratt. And so we sat down to a rather subdued lunch without a christened infant, and so on. And the infant was the present naval secretary, as they said. And I reminded him of this the other day. Of course, he had very little personal recollection, because he was a matter of weeks rather than months old. And then this left a very nasty taste in everyone's mouth. And at a reception in Valletta, 2 weeks later, Mrs. Mark Carr, the mother of this child, because their respective parents had really had to return to England because they hadn't catered for anything longer. And she bumped into Muspratt at this reception. And she looked at him coldly and said, "Ah, Mr. Muspratt, I see you do remember to come to some receptions," and turned away from him. And that was that one. On one occasion, when in Malta, in harbour, and I was duty officer, it always seemed to happen to me when I was duty officer, but never mind. And all was peace and quiet, and we were moored in Lazaretto Creek, as usual. and it was, I forget which day of the week it was, and it doesn't really matter. I can't remember whether it was even a Sunday or not. But around 3 o'clock or so in the afternoon, the duty petty officer came to me and said that a certain leading signalman called Muir had a birthday, and he'd over celebrated. And he was in danger. He seemed to be running amok on the mess deck. And I said, "Right, well, have the duty part stand by, and we'll see. Have you been up to him to see if he can you can quiet him down?" "Well, no, he hadn't. Well, go ahead and do that." And he came back to me and he said, "Sir, he's now standing on the forecastle. And he's swinging one of those circular cast iron or steel hatch covers about that thick, weighing about half a hundredweight, and swinging in his hands and saying he was going to do anybody that came near him." "Right," I said, "fall in the duty part and I will be up." Not at all clear what I was going to do when I went up. And this chap, who was huge, and he was an ex-Navy boxer, and so forth. and there he was, port side of the forecastle, just the far side of the gun, and he was swinging this single-handedly, just as if it was a ping-pong bat. And the duty part was reported to me by the duty petty officer, and I stood in front of them, and I looked along the line, and I said, "Now, in a moment, it would probably be necessary for me to order you to restrain leading signalman Muir before he hurts himself or somebody else." And as I looked down the line, they all shifted their eyes, and they made it absolutely clear to me that if I were to give such an order, they wouldn't do a sausage about it. And I realized this, and I thought, for Christ's sake, what does A do next? And so I said, stand by. And I turned on my heel with my heart in my mouth, and I went round to the other side. And there, slowly and quietly, I went up to this chap until I got quite as close as I am to you, and he was towering over me. And I said, Mia, don't be silly. I want to talk to you. Come down to my cabin. And I turned my back on him and equally slowly walked off the forecastle, wondering what it would feel like to have your skull crushed in by a metal hatchway wielded by leading signalman Muir, ex-Navy boxing champion. And I led him very slowly aft, and we got down to my cabin, and he went inside, and I shut the door, and I turned to him, and he burst into tears. But it was an interesting situation. So then, of course, we put him back to his mess with a sentry, preserve him, as it were. And that was the end of that one. Now, the next incident that occurred was that we did a refit in dock, and I thought that this was an admirable opportunity to take a thing called the Destroyer Command Exam. The form then was that if you were a salt horse, a non-specialist, non-subspecialist,